Hello, and welcome to the November edition of Newsline. Newsline is the magazine programme with items about Vista and other similar organisations and is available on CD, MP3 memory stick. It can be played along with our other talking newspapers on the Vista website, www.vistablind.org.uk, and is also available as a podcast. Now, if you have difficulty obtaining Newsline or your CD is faulty, then please call the Vista helpline on 0116 249 8839 and we'll send a replacement straight away. Now, before we start, I must apologise for the late arrival of your Newsline. This is due to the Vista relocation of their new offices, which are now based in Newark in Leicester. But I promise you we have a packed edition. So let's get on with it, I hear you say. We have a farewell message from former Chief Executive Paul Bott. We go over to the new Wycliffe home and hear from manager Julie Rudd. Also to the Kathleen Rutland home, where we have a new manager. Her name is Hayley, and we'll also hear from the activities organiser, Teresa. Josh is here from the Phoenix. He pops in to talk about their audio-described films. Dave Angel has an item all about National Braille Week and tells us about a very scary birthday present he recently received. Ken Russell has another edition of Meet the Manager, where he talks to various managers from Vista, and today he chats with New Opportunities Director Jamie McCrill. Vanessa loves running, and she's here to explain the fun of park runs with guide runners. The Vista Mobile Support Service vehicle, also known as Elsie, was recently at the Highcross Shopping Centre. I went along and spoke with Vista's Outreach and Inclusion Coordinator, Naina, and she told me why they were there. We hear from a group called Pottery Sight Loss. It's a local pottery group, and they're looking for new members. And Colette is here with the Healthline. So let's get started and say hello to Paul Bott.
Hello, everyone. It's Paul Bott here, Chief Executive of Vista. This is a special goodbye edition, I guess. This is my last Newsline as I'm leaving Vista. And as I record this at the end of September, I have just 2 working days left to go. I've been here for 6 years, and many of you will have heard me chuntering on about a whole series of matters. But I'm going to leave you with the speech that I'll deliver at this year's AGM. That's especially for the people who can't make it there this year. But before I go and I get into this, I'd like to say a special thanks to Dave, who records and puts these together. I know this is his job, but the way that he puts these together with support from Sarah and Vijay is what makes recording these news lines so much fun. So thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
That's all right. Okay, now for my AGM speech. Okay, so when I present this tomorrow, I will say this is my 5th and my last AGM speech, as I'll be leaving Vista at the end of this week to take up a new position as the chief executive of another charity. So today is a poignant event for me, and I'm going to try and keep it short. I say it every year that I find it a little odd that we report on last financial year, that is from the 1st of April to the 31st of March 2018, and yet here we are 6 months later on at the end of September when so much has happened in between. So if you'll allow me, I'll speak about what has happened in the last financial year, talk about what has happened over the last 6 months since year end, and then look forward to what comes next. It's a bit of an odd speech, this one, because it is my last one, so it's also a bit of a goodbye. The danger in talking about what we've achieved this year is that it just becomes a reiteration of what's in the annual report. And if anyone wants a copy of the annual report, it's available on the Vista website or by request in other accessible formats. I'll try and steer clear of the examples and case studies that are in the annual report, but I will say that I think it's a great piece of work in its own right. It really gives a feel for what Vista is about. It highlights the people that we are here to serve, and it expounds on our aspirations to be of more benefit. And I'd particularly like to thank all the people involved in the production of the report, particularly Kate and Shilpa. So what was achieved last year? Glyn, the finance director, has told us that we've made a surplus again. The money coming into the organisation is more than the money going out, and this year to the tune of £96,000. Now, that sounds a lot, but on a turnover of 8 million, that's just about 1%. I made the joke last year that I'd like to think that I've presented 5 years of surpluses at five AGMs and that those two facts might be connected. But in reality, I know that it's due to the decisions that we've made, the actions that we've taken in turbulent times, and the support and challenge of a strong board. In passing, I have spoken with some people considering applying for the role of to become Chief Executive of Vista, and many have commented on the strength of the board, and it's true. Looking at the trustees' CVs, they're a truly intimidating bunch. Fortunately, they are a bunch of very lovely people. It's great that the charity has made another surplus this year, but we don't exist to be financially healthy. The money side of the charity is not important at all, apart from the fact that it allows us to do all of the things that we do in the charity that achieve our wider aims in supporting more people affected by sight loss. On that point, more people had contact with Vista, with a Vista worker or a Vista volunteer, than ever before. There were over 17,000 in the past year, and that number has grown steadily from the 2,600 people that we reached in 2013 when I first joined Vista. Interestingly, in Leicester, Leicestershire and Rutland, the number of people who are registered as blind or partially sighted, or to be more accurate in our terminology, as being registered as sight impaired or severely sight impaired, has stayed roughly the same at around 6,000 people. But whilst it stayed the same, this has bucked the national trend of falling registrations. But I think that's probably more to do with the falling funding for sight loss specific services in other areas and a corresponding larger unmet need than an improvement in eye health. And this was a message that I delivered to the all-party parliamentary group on eye health earlier this year. But coming back to Leicester, Leicestershire and Rutland, the growth in the number of people supported is because we are fulfilling Vista's articles of association that state that we are a charity supporting people affected by sight loss. That line, affected by sight loss, is important. Of course it includes people who are registered as blind and partially sighted, but it also includes the parents supported by our paediatric ECLOS and family support service. It includes people who have sight loss that impacts on their lives, their ability to take part in their community and creates loneliness and isolation, but who do not yet meet the requirements of certification and registration. I'm proud of the fact that we are addressing the impact of sight loss for those affected by sight loss. I know, because I've had the conversation, that some people feel that we should just be a charity for people who are registered blind and partially sighted. And the conversations about how the charity spends its finite resources for the maximum benefit of the people we serve will, I'm sure, continue after my exit. We also have a public health requirement in our Articles of Association to prevent avoidable sight loss, and this is an area in which very little was done. The work that we are undertaking on vision screening with primary aged children, the use of ELSI, our mobile support service, the development of the screening app, and more recently, the excellent work with children and nurseries, helps to address this deficit. Now, I have no involvement with the appointment of my successor, and they will have their own plans about how to take Vista forward. But I know they will benefit from the work that we've completed over the past 6 years, just as I benefited from the work of Jenny Pierce, Gordon Diffie, and of course, Philip Parkinson. In moving forward, I'd like to think that we are now a more innovative organisation, with a focus on how to meet particular needs. And this concept of starting with the need is something that I've learnt from Steve Payne, our marvellous operations director. The nature of funding in short-term grants and uncertain funding arrangements and falling margins require us to be more innovative. And this nature of funding will not change over the coming years. It's my opinion that the charities will continue to develop and grow are those with diverse funding streams. We made that shift 5 years ago, but not all of our funding is new, and we continue to rely on the performance of our care homes to underpin the financial health of the organisation. That's part of the rationale behind investing in the redevelopment of the Leicester Forest East site, which currently houses Kathleen Rutland Home and Applegarth, and will house a new 72-bed care home for older people with sight loss, a new 12-bed care home for people with learning disabilities and sight loss, and 45 apartments for more independent living. This is the largest investment in the future of the charity ever undertaken by Vista, and it's not without its challenges. I look forward to seeing it progress, and if you'd like to invite me back, then I'd be happy to come for the grand opening. I know this has been an unconventional AGM speech, and I hope that you will indulge me. Each year I stand up and talk about how we've made a surplus, how we've won awards, and about the innovations in the year. And all of this is true again this year. But we've also seen the closing of some services because of the ending of funding, including the much-loved befriending service. We have seen a shrinking in the margins on contracts, and while we have made a surplus, this is due to extraordinary items. We should not gloss over the fact that in the year we actually spent more money on services than we had income to support those services. And that's not sustainable in the long term. At Vista, we recognise that in a changing world, we can't continue to do things the same way and expect the same outcomes. And this is reflected in the new strategic direction, which is purposefully called Working Together. Working Together contains three things that people said that they want Vista to do. Be an enabling and facilitative organisation that supports them to achieve. Be an organisation that amplifies the voice of people affected by sight loss. And be an ambitious organisation, because there is more to be done and there are more people to reach. I know that I'm leaving an organisation that is ambitious to be of more help to the people affected by sight loss. I know that I'm leaving an organisation that is full of good people working on a good plan. And I know that I am leaving this organisation, but I wish it and all of you, the trustees, the staff, the volunteers, the people we are here to serve, Dave, of course, and whoever the new chief executive of Vista is, all the very best for the future. So thank you all, and goodbye.
And our thanks and best wishes to Paul Bott.
Good morning, ladies and gents. Well, it's Julie again, manager at the New Wycliffe. I'm sure you all recognise my voice by now. Before I go too far into everything, I've got a special hello, and it just proves to me people do know who I am. I met a lovely young man called Phil. Phil will know who he is, who told me he listens to me on this newsline, and he came to have a look around with his family, looking for his father at some point. So, hi Phil. I shall move on to other stuff now. We've got quite a lot of disruption going on in the home this morning. 16 of our people that live here are getting ready to go on a boat trip. Now, anybody that knows the New Wycliffe, it's not an easy feat to get 16 people ready for a boat trip. But once they get out there, they'll have a lot of fun and they'll totally enjoy it. Things are winding down a little bit because, as we've all noticed now, we're coming to the end of summer. Autumn's upon us and the grounds are all looking a bit bare at the moment, but hopefully we won't have too much of a rough winter, but we'll wait and see. We've got a lot of things leading up to Christmas. Just for your information, and I'm sure that, I don't know whether Dave, I will be doing another news line before then, but on the, I think it's the, yes, the 8th of December, we're having our Christmas fair. We didn't have a summer fair this year, but the Christmas fair is going to be 2:30 to 4:30. We'll have lots of stalls indoors, and I'm sure Santa will be visiting. So if you want to come along and show your support, or if anybody's got any donations they want to make, we will have a tombola. And we will have bric-a-brac and all the normal things that you have at these functions. But it is quite a big fundraiser for us. We also have a lovely event, which we traditionally are known for, which is our Christmas party on the 18th of the 12th. And if there is anybody out there that wants to come and join us, feel free. At the moment, we're doing lots and lots of training. And just to run you by one of the ones that we're doing at the moment. Because of laws and legislations, we're currently doing a lot of training around moving and handling. And what that means is it's about keeping the member of staff safe and the person safe and using the correct ways and the correct procedures to support somebody if they've lost their mobility or they need to be hoisted. So at the moment, the staff are all going through refresher training, which we have to do yearly. So as you can imagine, At the moment, we've probably got about 85 staff that work here, and we have to make sure that they've all done their training and they're all up to date, and that we've assessed that they're competent to do that. That's a little bit about training. We normally have a training session at least once a month on various subjects. We've sadly lost, and I will say this is very sadly, our lady that was 105 that some of you may have known, Margaret Manshot, and her Nowhere family won't mind me mentioning her, passed away very peacefully a few weeks ago, and we had a memorial service for her the Saturday before, just to celebrate her life. And we all miss her tremendously because she passed away 2 weeks before her 106th birthday. Bit of a legend was our Margaret. So that currently means that we do have a couple of vacancies, but they are filling up quite quickly. So life at the New Wycliffe continues to remain very busy. But on a light-hearted note, I'm going on leave for a week today. And I'm off to Turkey, so I'm sure I'll tell you all about that when I get back. But take care, all of you, and I'll talk to you again soon. Bye.
Hello, I'm Vanessa. I'm visually impaired. I'm here sitting in the Vista office, and I want to talk to you about park runs. I first found out about the park runs when I went to the Leisure Centre gym in Market Harbour after many, many, many months of being lazy. I then met up with a lady called Jo who works there and says, would you be interested in running? I said, yes, please. I've never done it before, but I would love to give it a go. Following Saturday, she rang me, she picked me and Yassi up. We went down to the park and lo and behold, there must have been about 350 people there. Women, children, pushchairs, dogs, you name it, they were there. If you're a first-time runner, you don't have to run, you can walk, you can be at the very, very back and finish it in as long a time as you like. If you want to run, you can. But the main key thing is there's been lots of people that volunteer and they guide you around the park with either something that they hold in their hands, you can run beside them. If you have confidence enough, you can run behind them and follow them. And when you get to the very end, if you have got your barcode, which means you've registered with park runs all over the country, then you get your time printed and you get an email every single week letting you know how you're doing and what's your best performance. I recommend this to anybody. I've lost weight. I feel fitter. I feel happier. Everybody tells me so. So there you go. Don't stop yourselves from doing it if you haven't tried. There's all support out there to get you around that park every single Saturday at 9 o'clock all over the country. To know where this particular park run is that I do, it's 9 o'clock every Saturday morning, Market Harbour, Welland Park. You need to be there about 8:30, if not a little bit before, in order to get all your instructions about your volunteer. Thank you.
Thanks, Vanessa. Hopefully she'll come back soon and tell us more. In a few minutes' time, we'll find out why Vista was at the Highcross Shopping Centre recently. But first, let's go over to the Kathleen Rutland home and hear from Teresa and the newly appointed manager, Hayley.
Hi, I'm Hayley, the manager at the Kathleen Rutland home. I've newly been registered with the CQC. We have currently have vacancies at the Kathleen Rutland home. We will be open on the 24th of November and we'll be holding an open day. That will also be our Christmas fair, so you can come and join in on the raffle and the games that are on that day. But please feel free in the meantime to call up and arrange an appointment to come and have a look around the home if you're interested. You can contact me on 01162 394 234, or you can also arrange for a brochure to be sent to your home calling this number if you're interested. Thank you.
Hi, it's Teresa from Kathleen Rutland. I've not been on Newsline for a couple of months due to sound services moving to the new offices, but David has been so kind to come to me at the home for me to be called this month's Newsline, and I'd like to thank you, David. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Well, lots have happened over the past couple of months within the home. One of our residents celebrated her 94th birthday. She informed me she had never had a birthday party and that she would like one. So we arranged one for her. We invited many of her friends within the homes and many staff attended. She really enjoyed herself. And as a memory of it, I've made her a photo frame up of the event. We've had lots of birthdays over the past couple of months. We always ask the individual how they would like to celebrate their special day. Some choose meals out with a group of their choice. Some choose probably a coffee morning. And some just want to spend it within the home, a quiet time. But everybody within the home gets a birthday cake on the day because we try to make these days as special as we can for them. On the 23rd of September, we took a group to De Montfort Hall to a show called Our Finest Hour. The BBC Big Band captured the spirit of the 1940s, looking back in words and music of the momentous turning point of World War II and Britain's finest hour. From the miracle of Dunkirk to the decisive victory of the Battle of Britain. They performed many songs from Vera Lynn and Gracie Fields to Andrew Sisters and Glenn Miller. I can honestly say it was the most amazing, enjoyable afternoon. We all really enjoyed it. The week commenced in the 24th of September. It was National Cupcake Week. So we had a great time making, decorating and eating many cupcakes. Myself and my colleague Lindsay make the most amazing cupcakes, so it just had to be done with our residents within the home. We've had our usual in-house entertainment come to sing for us. One of them was our resident's family member who sang for us many old 1940s and 50s songs where we all joined in with a sing-along. We also had a recruitment day, which was very successful, and an open day for members of the public to come and look round our home. We also do themed evening, I think I've mentioned before, and we always give our residents the choice on the occasion what they would like to choose. On this one, they chose a fish and chip meal. And normally we get quite a good group to join in, but on this one, the majority of the residents chose to join in. So it was one big early evening fish and chip meal together, which was really nice. On October the 20th, we put on a wartime party and invited family and friends to join in with us. Again, this was another successful afternoon. We decorated up with many props like an air raid shelter entrance, a sentry box and many more, all made by our maintenance guys who never let us down. We put sandbags and camouflage around with flags and bunting. It really did look amazing. We also put on wartime food. Our entertainment on the day were two lovely ladies called the Bluebird Bells who dressed up and sang many wartime songs. We like to take our residents shopping when we can, and on one occasion we had two ladies request to go to Marks and Spencer's for themselves. So we had a nice day taking them for coffees and lunch and made a real day of it. They were both absolutely thrilled with the day and their purchases. On the run-up to Christmas, we have a lot happening within the home. We have bonfire night coming up, we've got accordion players coming in, we've got a group of clog dancers. We have the Remembrance Day Parade. We've also been invited to the Hinkley Lights Switch On, where we drive through with our minibus, and several Christmas meals out with our residents. Also, on the 24th of November, we have our Christmas Fair, which will be held in our Sun Lounge at Kathleen Rutland, and a Christmas party for family, friends and everybody on the 15th of December. But I will tell you more about these events on the next newsline. But until then, take care, everyone. Bye.
Thank you, Teresa. And I notice while we're sitting here talking at this table, you mentioned cakes earlier on.
Yes.
The tablecloth's covered in cakes.
It is.
Not real cakes, but prints of cakes.
And this is one of the tablecloths that we use when we do our displays.
When you do your display. It looks lovely. Well, thanks again, Teresa, and we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Thank you very much, David.
And now here's a reminder of how you can get your free copy of our 4-CD set commemorating World War I.
To commemorate the centenary of the First World War, Vista Sound Services have obtained funding from the Heritage Lottery Fund to produce a 4-CD set of recordings – memoirs and diaries from local soldiers, poetry, comedy, and music. Local experts and historians talk about life at the front and at home, and there's a section devoted to the role of women during the war.
The Soldier by Rupert Brooke. If I should die, think only this of me, that there's some corner of a foreign field that is forever England. There shall be, in that rich earth, a richer dust concealed, a dust whom England bore, shaped, made aware, gave once her flowers to love, her ways to roam, a body of England's, breathing English air, washed by the rivers, blessed by suns of home. And think, this heart, all evil shed away, a pulse in the eternal mind no less, gives somewhere back the thoughts by England given, her sights and sounds, dreams happy as her day, and laughter learnt of friends, and gentleness in hearts at peace, under an English heaven.
This limited edition 4CD set is available free, and if you'd like to order your copy, then please call the Vista helpline on 0116 249 8839.
For the forests of Arden never called to me as when I think of men I've lost in fields where poppies grow. And my heart still yearns for love under dark somber skies above and the girl I left behind in a kibbutz grove.
Order your copy now. 0116 249 8839.
Pack up your troubles in your own kit bag and smile, smile, smile.
Here we are at the High Cross Shopping Centre and we're talking with Naina Surti. Naina, welcome to Newsline for the first time.
Hello, David.
So, what's your actual job? Again, I can see it on your badge, but you tell us.
I will tell you. I've just started recently as an outreach and inclusion coordinator for the VMSS bus and also managing the social groups as well. So, we go out into the county, quite a lot of different places with our Vista bus, and we do free eye screening on there for people who would like to have an eye screened if they've not been to the opticians for a while. We have lots of leaflets on Vista services and what Vista do, and also things like if you're diabetic or if you've got glaucoma or macular degeneration. We've even got leaflets on that. And we've been very lucky with the weather here this week at High Cross. So we've done plenty of eye screenings today and the last 2 days. So we're going to carry on and be here for the rest of the week until Friday.
And lots of people walking past and looking over. And as you said earlier, a lot of people actually taking part in the eye screening. I think I heard Kath Bailey say the other day, it's not a test as such, is it? It's just a screening to see if there could be any problems with your eyes. Is that right?
Exactly. Well, basically, we've had a lot of people who have said they've never been to the opticians or they're due to go, but they can't remember to book in. So it's just an initial screening and they can take the results to the optician. So after the screening, we may recommend that you need to see an optician for further advice.
Okay, can you cover your left eye? Can you tell me if the lines appear darker than the other? Do they look about the same?
It looks darker from the left. The middle is light and then it goes darker again.
Okay, it's darker, yeah. Okay. Now cover your right eye. Okay, look at the circles on the screen and tell me if they stand out on the red or green background or do they look about the same?
Red, red, yeah.
Can you cover your left eye for me? Thank you. Again, look at the circles on the screen and tell me if they stand out
on red.
Red. Hey, don't need that now. I'm going to check your colour deficiency. So look ahead again. Can you tell me what number you see?
Eight.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, what I would like to say is, on a personal note as well, because I also have suffered from retinal detachment and retinal tears, is that a lot of people, they seem to look after their body, they go to the gym regularly, they do their hair, they do their nails, but we sometimes forget that our eyes also need looking after. So please, anyone who's listening, please make sure you're looking after your eyes as well, because at the end of the day, all these things that you're doing, if you can't see, you won't be able to see yourself in the mirror very well anyway, that you've done your hair or you've done your makeup correctly. So I advise people to go and have your eyes checked regularly.
Excellent. And that's good advice for anyone listening to this who may be a relative or a friend of someone who's already registered with Vista, perhaps. And they're just the kind of people that probably would neglect their own self because they're probably looking after someone else. So it's a good reminder to always remember that you've got to check yourself as well.
Yep, I agree there.
Can I just ask you a very, very quick question? When was the last time you had your eyes tested?
Oh, about a week ago.
A week ago? That's very good.
Right, well, Naina, thanks ever so much for talking to us. I'll leave you to get on with your very busy day. Thank you.
Thank you very much, David.
So this is Ken Russell with another one of those occasional meet the manager interviews that we carry out from time to time on Newsline. A vehicle in which I come face to face with one of Vista's managers and I explore their responsibilities within the organisation and I try to find out a little bit about the person themselves. Well, this time round, we meet Jamie McCrill, who is Vista's new opportunities director. Jamie, welcome.
Hello.
New opportunities director. Sounds good on paper, but what's it all about in reality? What's required of you on a daily basis?
Good question, and one I get asked a lot when people say, what is your job? So I guess my role sits somewhere between innovation and new business. So I look at what the services that we offer now and understand the impact that they have. Where they're most effective and where there are gaps in provision. And I design services around those gaps in provision. The new business part is that then I'll go out and, along with the income generation team, look at how we fund those new initiatives. And also look at maybe not funding them through traditional means, but through more sustainable routes as well. So day to day, I look at outcomes data from how effective our services are. I generate ideas and I also look at how we can get these things funded.
Talk about the new ideas. Basically, you're a walking suggestion box.
Yes. A walking suggestion box based on ideas that will take Vista forward. It's about obviously making sure what we're doing and what works really well is sustainable, but also making sure that we're meeting the new needs that emerge within the people affected by sight loss.
Are you open to suggestions from others and you can develop suggestions that people come to you
Absolutely.
With?
Absolutely. I think everything that I do, and this is partly from my background, is always around understanding need. And you can understand need through either looking at numerical data, sort of crunching numbers, or you can understand need through talking to people. And the best way of finding it out is through both. So in the past, we have run sort of focus group and things around understanding what people need out of particular service, so we've done that with the Digital Buddy scheme, for example. And we've also looked at sort of ideas boxes, really, where we ran a workshop with young adults around what their perceptions on everyday technology as well.
So who got invited to that?
So we used some of our existing groups that were running in the children's and young people services. So we tend to tie them on to existing activities that are taking place, existing events that take place, because then it's easier for us to sort of, people don't have to go out their way quite as much and things like that. And in the future we could run, if there's a particular topic that we want to get some user views on, then that is a mechanism that we could use is to run workshops in the future and invite people to it.
It's a difficult situation sometimes where an organisation which is here to serve people who can't see, if someone who is trying to do a job actually can see perfectly well, first, before they can do anything at all, they have to understand what it's like to be partially sighted or blind. Yeah. How do you cope with that? How do you learn how what the needs would be of somebody who can't see?
I think it comes down to speaking to people and also speaking to the staff who run our services, because they have such a detailed knowledge, really, of kind of what works and what doesn't work in supporting people with sight loss. I mean, I think there's always that challenge where if you don't have the first-hand experience, you're never quite going to, you know, understand it in its fullest. But I think through those means we cover those bases as well. And I think also it's part of the new service design is making sure that it ties into the direction that Vista's going as an organisation as well. So I think sometimes that's a challenge, is working out, saying, well, we know that we need to be doing this service, understanding the funding landscape and also understanding the direction we're going as an organisation is...
I know some people have said in the past, they seem to think that their views are not actually being directly addressed. Is there any way in which your responsibilities can ease that for them?
We run consultations every now and again, depending on what we need, depending on the services that we're kind of developing. So I think those mechanisms are really useful. The other thing we've done recently was for a project that we're developing, we ran consultation around rural Leicestershire, and we had a series of activities that people were able to contribute, and it was held during the summer, so we would turn up at village fates and things like that, and people could get directly involved in that way. So we do use a lot of kind of consultation methods, and sometimes it depends on exactly the information that we need, depends on the different kind of mechanisms that we use.
You mentioned earlier about your background.
Yes.
Your background is lecturing in engineering.
It is.
What sort of engineering?
I lectured on a subject called human factors or ergonomics, which is essentially designing for human use. So that can range from a product such as a chair through to an environment. So my PhD was in hospital environment design, through to services. So my background is all around how do we design for those needs, designing for their use. Well, people use services, and for effective design you need to understand need, and that's how it all kind of ties together.
Yes, I mean, it is misleading in a way to say engineering, because you would naturally assume that's either mechanical or electrical or whatever. But ergonomics, if we said your background is ergonomics, I think most people would understand where you're coming from.
Yeah.
And that's the relevance of what you're now doing.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's more than just thinking up ways of doing things that affects the human body.
Yeah.
There are the ramifications as well.
Absolutely.
Did you find that in yours?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was always designed through to implementation. So, and there's always a kind of challenge to balance what the absolute, you know, what the absolute kind of utopia design solution would be with the resources available and the infrastructure that can deliver it. So,
yeah, practicalities.
Always got to be a bit pragmatic about these things. So, yeah.
The family tree of Vista lists the three main headings that come under your control, partnerships, innovation, research and outcomes.
Yeah.
You've covered most of it, but can we delve a little bit deeper into the innovation part of it?
Yes.
What is your understanding of that particular
innovation.
Discipline within your responsibility?
Yeah, well, I think it's a good question, because a lot of times people always say, oh, you know, it's important to have innovation, and it can be across any different type of organisation. But to me, innovation, it's easy to have ideas. Ideas are easy, but
it's,
I think,
carrying them out, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I think it turns into innovation when it's actually deployed in practice and it becomes sustainable. And to me, that's what innovation is. So I think in terms of the new service offerings, is when we've been looking at how we make that sustainable, it's actually looking at, okay, well, what resources do we need? So actually making better use of volunteers, so it can become a more sustainable service at a more sustainable cost, is really important. And to me, that's what innovation is. It's not just about drawing diagrams on whiteboards, which is what I do as well.
Indeed, indeed. But when you say that it's important to have contact with people and to consult directly with people to find out what are their needs at that particular time, on a daily basis, how do you go about that? How much of your day is spent actually consulting people?
if I was supposed to give it as a percentage, it would be a very small percentage. But I think my day-to-day is also around sort of helping run the organisation as well. But in terms of the actual engagement consultation, it's not necessarily the absolute time we spend capturing that information that should be measured by. It's the fact that when we've done those types of consultations, the planning to make sure that we're getting the information we need and that we can make use of that information is key.
So, the talking is the short bit, but the long bit is the analysis.
Yeah, the analysis. Yeah, exactly. So the analysis is the really important thing to us.
Yeah. Well, that's your background of you and the background to what you are now employed to do here at Vista. But what about the person? When your day at Vista is finished...
Yeah.
And we're all human beings. You disappear thinking, oh, another day over. How do you unwind?
So my absolute love is cycling.
Not up and down New Walk, I hope.
Absolutely not. That is a pedestrian-only zone. But yeah, cycling's what I love. So if I could spend all day on my bike, I would. I'm probably about 15 in reality in my head. But yeah, cycling. And then when I get home, life's pretty full. I have a 21-month-old daughter. Awful lot of fun, doesn't sleep much. So Dad's quite exhausted at the moment, especially now the clocks have gone back, because we seem to be wanting to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning now. But yeah, it's lots of fun, so I wouldn't change it for the world.
When you first came, obviously you had expectations as to what it was going to be like.
Yeah.
Did it fulfil your expectations as to what you would get out of it? Let's say we've covered... in this interview, yeah, yeah. What you are trying to accomplish, yeah, on behalf, yeah, of people who can't see. But on a personal note, did the job give you the satisfaction that you thought it would?
Yes, is the short answer.
That's good enough.
It was, yeah, exactly, leave it there. Yeah, no, it did. I've learned a huge amount since I came here. I've learned a huge amount around what it means to run an organisation. And I think, from coming from an academic background where you talk about theories a lot, actually understanding the challenges of implementing them in practice has been a huge learning, and one that I'm much better at now. Because I think when I first started, I was very much doing it as a, you know, I should be doing this as a textbook and how I've read about it for however long. But actually doing it for real has been, you know, you understand you have to be practical about these things. And actually it makes it far more enjoyable as well.
Well, thank you for being so open with me.
That's all right.
And that's this time round, Meet the Manager. Thank you very much, Jamie.
Thank you.
And now on Newsline, I'm very pleased to say we're joined by Josh from The Phoenix. Welcome, Josh.
Hello, I'm Josh. I'm the Cinema Programme Assistant at Phoenix in Leicester. And I'm here to talk about our audio description headsets. So at the start of the year, we did a crowdfunding campaign. We asked our audience to help us raise £2,000 to buy 26 new amplified headsets. To provide audio description for films. So that's description between gaps in dialogue for people who have visual impairment. So we currently now have a stock of about 36 headsets that we use. My role is kind of trying to develop sort of awareness of these headsets and what films you can see with the headsets. So films are provided to us, and not all films are provided with an audio description track. A few each month are, so we get sort of between 5 and 7 a month. So my job is to make sure that those are listed correctly on the website so that people can book and come along and use the headsets and see films. So multiplexes don't really do this very well, and other independent cinemas tend to do it on a weekly basis, whereas we're more monthly. So at the start of the month when we're doing our brochure, I look ahead, see what films are coming up, and make sure they're listed. So hopefully when you go on a website under Access Cinema, you can see a good range of stuff. Yeah.
So if someone goes to the website to see what films are on, it will say which ones are audio described?
Yes, if you go to our What's On page and then to Access Cinema, then to audio description, so 3 clicks, and then there's a list of films there. So that's all the screenings under that time. So all the times under that film will be available with the audio description when you pick up a headset, basically. It works with those. And then we also do once a month a dedicated audio described screening that we advertise in our brochure. It's always on a Friday evening that we earmark out for people who want to sort of have a regular weekly screening each month. So what we're trying to work on at the moment is making people aware that, you know, it tends to be the big films are provided with audio description. You can come as a range of times. You can come in the evening or the afternoon or the morning to see them.
Well, thanks, Josh. If anyone listening to this now wants to know perhaps more details or how they can get involved, what should they do?
The best place to see the list of audio described films that we have each month is on our website. So that's phoenix.org.uk. If you go to What's On and then you go to Access Cinema and Audio Described, there's a big picture of a headset and there's a list of all the films there. You book the same as you always do. The best way to book would be to give us a call. That's 0116 242 2800, and just let the person in the box office know that you're coming along and you want to use a headset, so you've pre-booked it, and we'll set one aside for you when you arrive. If you don't, we don't answer, we always call back. That's probably the best way to go about it, just to make sure you can guarantee that you're going to turn up and the headset will be ready for you and working. And we can provide a demo if you need to when you arrive, if you're not sure how to use it.
Thank you, Josh.
That's all right. Okay, no worries.
Hello and welcome to Healthline with me, Colette Hall. Chinese tech giant Tencent and London medical firm Medopad have teamed up to use artificial intelligence in the diagnosis of Parkinson's disease. A camera captures the way patients move their hands to determine the severity of their symptoms. The research team has trained the system with existing videos of patients who have been assessed by doctors working with King's College Hospital in London. Dr. Wei Fan, head of the Tencent Medical AI Lab, explained, "We use the AI to measure the deterioration of Parkinson's disease in patients without the patient wearing any sensors or device. The aim is to speed up a motor function assessment process, which usually takes more than half an hour. Using smartphone technology developed by Medopad, the hope is that patients could be assessed within 3 minutes and might not even have to attend a hospital." Medopad is a London-based firm that has been developing apps and wearable devices to monitor patients with various medical conditions. It has been growing fast, but is a minnow compared with Tencent, which is spearheading China's huge investment in AI. Medopad's chief executive, Dan Vordat, said that there was no British company that could match what Tencent offered as a partner. He said, "Our ambition is to impact 1 billion patients around the world, and to be able to get to that kind of scale, we need to work with partners that have international reach." Wei Fan also emphasises the scale of his company's ambition in health AI, stressing that it is focused on helping to treat diseases that affect very large numbers of patients. As many as 10 million people worldwide are thought to be living with Parkinson's, and that number is likely to grow as it is a condition more common among the elderly. Now, advances in AI techniques promise to make it easier for doctors to prescribe treatment to alleviate the symptoms. According to researchers, regularly eating foods like bacon and sausages may raise the risk of breast cancer. A review of studies found women who ate high levels of processed meat had a 9% increased risk of cancer compared with those who ate little of it. The study backs up previous findings of the World Health Organization, which says processed meats cause cancer. Experts recommend caution about the findings and say the actual risk for individual women is very small. In the UK, about 14 out of every 100 women will get breast cancer at some point in their lives. That means a 9% increase in risk in this population would be expected to translate into roughly one extra case of cancer in every 100 women. Cancer Research UK estimates that about 23% of breast cancers are preventable. It estimates that about 8% of cases are caused by being overweight and obese, and another 8% by alcohol. Authors of this study, published in the International Journal of Cancer, say the link they found is only for processed meat, not red meat. The WHO lists processed meat as carcinogenic, primarily because of evidence linking it to a raised risk of bowel cancer, while it says red meat is probably carcinogenic. What is processed meat? Well, processed meat has been modified to either extend its shelf life or change the taste, usually by smoking, curing, or adding salt or preservatives to meat. This includes bacon, sausages, hot dogs, salami, corned beef, beef jerky, and ham. There are different theories for why it may raise the risk of cancer, including that curing salt may react with protein in the meat to make it carcinogenic. This study, which included data on more than a million women, shows a link between processed meat consumption and breast cancer risk, but it's not clear if the food is actually causing this. Currently, the NHS recommends eating no more than 70 grams of red and processed meat a day. An emergency £240 million will be pumped into social care in England to ease pressure on the NHS this winter by enabling more elderly people to be cared for at home. Health Secretary Matt Hancock told the Tory conference that the cash will help councils pay for measures like housing adaptations and care packages, and getting people back home will free up hospital beds. Critics said the funding was nowhere near enough. In January, one in five patients faced long delays for a bed. The number of seriously ill patients facing delays for a bed reached record highs, with 1,000 waiting more than 12 hours, according to NHS England figures. This was despite a mass cancellation of routine treatments designed to ease pressure. Mr. Hancock, who was given responsibility for health and social care in July, set out the additional funding on the third day of the Conservative Party conference in Birmingham. He suggested that the money to be channelled through local authorities according to their relative adult social care needs could buy 71,500 domestic care packages or 86,500 re-ablement packages. He said, "We will use this money to get people who don't need to be in hospital but do need care back home, back into their communities, so we can free up those vital hospital beds and help people who really need it get the hospital care they need." Reacting to Mr. Hancock's speech, Shadow Social Care Minister Barbara Keeley said tinkering at the edges was not going to solve a severe crisis in social care caused by 8 years of Tory austerity. Ian Hudspeth, who chairs the Local Government Association's Community Wellbeing Board, said short-term bailouts were not the answer. Mr. Hancock indicated the government would publish a paper on reforming social care later in the year. Research suggests that artificial sweeteners found in Diet Coke and other soft drinks could damage your gut bacteria. Scientists found six sweeteners, all approved for use in foods and drinks in the US and EU, were toxic to gut microbes. They included the controversial aspartame, which has been at the centre of critical reports dating back decades. It is used in Diet Coke. Researchers from Israel and Singapore warned that the findings offer further evidence that artificial sweeteners can damage health. A healthy gut microbiome, it has been associated with everything from improved hormone regulation, nutrient absorption, digestion and immune system function. As well as aspartame, the scientists also assessed sucralose, saccharin, neotame, advantame and acesulfame potassium K. 10 sports supplements that contain these sweeteners were also analysed for the study, published in the journal Molecules. The study was led by a team of Ben-Gurion University of the Negev and Nanyang Technological University in Singapore. In their laboratory trial, all six of the sweeteners were exposed to bacteria that are commonly found in the human gut. These bacteria were genetically modified to contain fluorescent compounds that glow when they detect toxins. The researchers discovered toxins are released when gut bacteria are exposed to artificial sweeteners in the lab. It only took 1 mg/mL of the artificial sweeteners to turn the bacteria toxic. And the higher the amount of artificial sweetener, the more toxins that are released, according to the team led by Professor Ariel Kushmaro. He said, "This is further evidence consumption of artificial sweeteners adversely affects gut microbial activity, which can cause a wide range of health issues. The results of this study might help in understanding the relative toxicity of artificial sweeteners and the potential of negative effects on the gut microbial community." Diet drinks account for a quarter of the sweetened beverages market, but there is growing evidence they are not as healthy as previously thought. Although marketed as a diet-friendly alternative to sugary drinks, scientists say they should no longer be regarded as the healthier alternative. Artificial sweeteners have repeatedly been linked to obesity, cancer, type 2 diabetes, migraines, and even liver toxicity. The sweeteners are also emerging as environmental pollutants due to them being resistant to wastewater treatment processes. Professor Kushmaro added the findings could also help to detect the damage that artificial sweeteners have on the environment. Aspartame has established itself as an important component in many low-calorie, sugar-free foods and beverages. In 2015, it was reported that it is consumed by more than 200 million people around the world and is found in more than 6,000 products. These include carbonated soft drinks, powdered soft drinks, chewing gum, dessert mixes, puddings and fillings, and some vitamins and sugar-free cough drops. Aspartame is a nutritive sweetener made by joining two amino acids, L-phenylalanine and L-aspartic acid, with a third component called a methyl ester group. Very little is needed for a sweet taste, making aspartame virtually non-caloric. It is thought to be up to 200 times sweeter than sucrose. More people may be opting for artificial sweetened drinks after a sugar tax on soft drinks was introduced in the UK on April the 6th. Drinks with more than 8 grams of sugar per 100 ml are taxed 24 pence per litre. Those containing 5 to 8 grams of sugar per 100 ml are hit with a lower tax of 18 pence per litre. A new outbreak of a rare but preventable eye infection that can cause blindness has been identified in contact lens wearers in a new study led by UCL and Moorfields Eye Hospital researchers. The research team found a threefold increase in acanthomoeba keratitis since 2011 in southeast England. Reusable contact lens wearers with the eye infection are more likely to have used an ineffective contact lens solution, have contaminated their lenses with water, or reported poor contact lens hygiene, according to the findings published in the British Journal of Ophthalmology. Professor John Dart, UCL Institute of Ophthalmology and Moorfields Eye Hospital NHS Foundation Trust, said this infection is still quite rare, usually affecting 2.5 in 100,000 contact lens users per year in southeast England, but it's largely preventable. This increase in cases highlights the need for contact lens users to be aware of the risks. Acanthomoeba keratitis is an eye disease that causes the front surface of the eye, the cornea, to become painful and inflamed due to infection by acanthomoeba, a cyst-forming microorganism. The most severely affected patients, a quarter of the total, have less than 25% of vision or become blind following the disease and face prolonged treatment. Overall, 25% of people affected require corneal transplants to treat the disease or restore vision. Anyone can be infected, but contact lens users face the highest risk due to a combination of increased susceptibility to infection for reasons not fully established, as a result of contact lens wear and contamination of lens cases. The researchers collected incidence data from Moorfields Eye Hospital from 1985 to 2016. They found an increase dating from 2000 to 2003, when there were 8 to 10 cases per year, to between 36 to 65 annual cases in the past few years. As Moorfields treats more than 1 in 3 cases of the disease in the UK, the researchers expect their findings are relevant to the UK more broadly. Alongside these findings, they conducted a case control study of people who wear reusable contact lenses on a daily basis, although the disease is also associated with disposable lenses, comparing those who had a diagnosis of acanthomoeba keratitis to those who had come into Moorfields A&E for any other reason from 2011 to 2014. The case control study included 63 people with acanthomoeba keratitis and 213 without. They all completed a questionnaire from which the researchers found that the risk of developing the disease was more than 3 times greater amongst people with poor contact lens hygiene, people who did not always wash and dry their hands before handling their lenses, those who use a lens disinfectant product containing oxypol, now phased out by the manufacturer, and for people who wore their contacts while in swimming pools or hot tubs. Showering and face washing while wearing contact lenses are also likely to be risk factors. Acanthomoeba is more commonly found in the UK than in other countries, likely due to higher levels found in domestic, as opposed to mains, water supplies, so that water contamination of contact lenses is of particular concern in the UK. The researchers say the current outbreak is unlikely to be due to any one of the identified risk factors in isolation. Professor Dart said people who wear reusable contact lenses need to make sure they thoroughly wash and dry their hands before handling contact lenses and avoid wearing them while swimming, face washing or bathing. Daily disposable lenses, which eliminate the need for contact lenses cases or solution, may be safer, and we are currently analysing our data to establish the risk factors for these. That's all for now. There's more in the next edition of Healthline.
Right, so now we have a quiet corner in the office. We have a group called Pottery Site Loss, and this group is run by the Leicester Adult Skills and Learning Service here in Leicester, just around the corner, in fact. Catherine is here and is going to tell us a little bit about it.
So I'm Catherine. I teach the class. I teach beginners. I teach people who have been to pottery classes before, very experienced people. We try to add to their knowledge. And on the class, we use all sorts of multi-sensory resources to try and bring all the sort of tactile elements to the subject. And pottery itself is a very tactile subject. And we will take on sculptural projects, functional projects, and really you can design the course around yourself. We're a very friendly bunch. There's a lot of a great social aspect to the course. So there's a lot of chat that goes on whilst we're working. And we just need a few more people to bring a new dynamic into it and hopefully another element of the social side. And if anyone did want to come in, you could always try the class first. You don't have to sign up. We'll be running right up till Christmas, and we do have some sessions on the 13th of November, the 20th of November and the 27th of November, all Tuesdays, 10:30 till 12:30. And if you wanted to just come along and have a little free taster to see what you think, see if it would be something you'd be interested in signing up for after Christmas, you could give us a call. You could ring Catherine Burks on 0116 454 0659.
Thanks, Catherine, for that. Marissa, you've been on the team the longest.
Yeah.
Tell us what you've been up to.
Well, yeah, as I said, I've been coming for quite a long time, since when it started at Vista, when it was in Geddon Road, and I really enjoy it. And
What's your best memory of the course so far? Anything you've made or any friends you've made?
I think there's a lot of it, really. I enjoy coming every week to get to know people, and it's a way to get out and get on the bus and the journey getting to the class, and making a lot of things that I've ended up giving away to people and they've really liked them. And I enjoy each thing that we make on its journey, from just having the clay and shaping it and it's fired and we've glazed it, and it just comes out into something that people can like and enjoy. And I've made a lot of friends, and I used to have a guide dog, and I used to do a couple of models of him in different ways, and one of them I gave to a good friend.
It sounds like you've had a really enjoyable time over the years, because you've been doing it for such a long time. Do you find that you tend to help other people, especially new members?
Yeah, I think we always tried to. I mean, like Catherine said at the beginning, we just naturally chat anyway during the course, because we've all got things in common and in similar situations. And what I find as well, it's good because people come from different areas as well. You get people from all over the city and the county, so that shouldn't discourage anyone from coming as well if they live a bit too far away or whatever, because then they can learn the routes and there's ways around to get to places. And we try and help each other out when we can, and people get to know each other, so they can just ask anything to the group, and wherever there's another member that can give people ideas or advice, we will, just naturally in conversation. Yeah.
Thank you, Marissa. From a lady that's been in the group quite a while, we'll talk to a lady that's only just joined. Yeah. Christine, how are you getting on so far?
Fine. I've made several things. I tend to think my grandchildren could probably have made them better, but I very much enjoyed them. I have always enjoyed working with my hands, embroidery, patchwork, such things like that. Mm. I can no longer see to do these things because of macular degeneration. So the tactile part of the pottery is extremely useful to me. I feel, although I can't necessarily see all the things I've done on it, that I am having a good stab at it and I'm enjoying it. I've tried using the wheel. We've got a lot of success, but there's always room for improvement. And the tasks that Catherine gives us to do are all very enjoyable, and we can also choose to do things of our own if we want.
What's your favourite masterpiece so far?
Oh, I don't have one. It's always going to be the next one, isn't it?
Ah, good.
Yes, okay. The next one we're making, with in view to Christmas, really, are hanging bells and wind chimes, which I'm hoping to make some to give to my children. So that's obviously going to be the best. At the moment, I haven't really done... I've done various pots that have ended up around the garden.
Yeah.
So, and they're nice and colourful, and the birds eat seed out of them, but none of them are terribly good, but I can improve.
Oh, I'm sure they are. Well, look, good luck with your Christmas decorations, and let's talk to Helen. How long have you been with the group, Helen?
I've been doing pottery at the Adult Education College for about 3 years now. I really enjoy just 2 hours of thinking about nothing else, just handling and manipulating the clay, which feels so lovely and soft. And it's the process that I enjoy, of learning about the properties of clay, how you can shape it and join bits. So the things that we make are probably a bit rough and ready, but it's the process that I really enjoy.
It's the fun of actually getting together and having a go. Christine mentioned the wheel. I think anyone who's never done pottery always think of that wheel, don't they? Yeah, because I think you'd be terrified at having a go at that, getting clay all over the room and all over everyone else. What's the secret?
It's not as messy as you'd think. But again, it's finding out how a lump of clay moves between your fingers. And we've ended up with some funny shaped pots, but that doesn't matter.
Well, I suppose you could say if it's art, then it's not wrong, is it? It's just different.
Very much so, yeah. Yes.
Have you been in the group long, Colin?
It's about 3 or 4 years. Fran and I were talking about it one day, because she'd been coming a number of years. I thought, should I give it a go? You know, I'm not really into this sort of thing, but it's never too late to start learning something new, you know. I thought, well, it'd be good. So in the end, I thought, well, why not give it a go? You know, I've got nothing to lose. And so that's when I started coming.
And what have you actually got out of the course so far in your own satisfaction?
I think for me, well, part of it's a social aspect of it, because I have an issue with large groups, joining large groups, because in a large group, because I'm totally blind, I've always been totally blind, I can't use eye contact. And so it's very difficult in a large group to engage in conversation with people and their review, because some people just aren't used to people. They're just not used to not using eye contact. Mm. And so for me, I come here every week, always look forward to it. It's a social side. It's only a small group, but we have fun, you know. We work together, we learn together, we laugh together and have fun together. And it's...
And you can also get your hands dirty.
You can also get your hands dirty, oh yeah.
Yeah. Now, just before you came, Colin, we were talking to Helen, and she was talking about the wheel.
Oh,
and,
yes.
And you had a go on the wheel.
For my first time in my life... A little bit at first, but I got to love it. You know, I only used it for the first time last term, during the summer term, I think it was. And I really loved it. I've made 2 pots.
Did you make loads of mess, though?
Well, yes, a bit, but you have to learn how to handle that. Keeping your clay on centre and that sort of
good
thing.
For you.
There's an art to it, you know.
Yeah,
but
I'm sure there is.
And you, not to go too fast, not to go too, you know, and then make sure you don't go off the edge, you know, we can be utter chaos. But I loved using the wheel. Well, that's the first time I'd ever done it in my life.
I think you got a lot of satisfaction from making something.
I loved it.
Yeah. Brilliant. Thank you, Colin. Fiona's here as well.
Hello. I provide support in the class, so I think that kind of really helps with the group, because quite a lot of them don't have sight at all, so we tend to support them in other ways, like visualising it in their mind through texture and explanation. So I think that adds a lot to the group. I think you'd all agree, doesn't it?
Yes.
To some degree, anyway. So you're not alone, kind of thing, with the tutor in the class. So, you know, it'd be a great asset, you know, if more people were to come along. So it's a great group, very friendly. We do lots of things. And as Colin was saying, we go on the wheel, we do all sorts of stuff, we work with all sorts of textures and mediums, so well worth coming along.
Thanks, Fiona. Well, that sounds absolutely fabulous. Anyone listening to this right now who thinks they'd like to get involved, Catherine, do you want to just run through the details again?
Yeah. So if you just wanted to just come and have a try, meet us all. If you've got a guide dog, bring your guide dog along. If you want to just pop in for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, half an hour, the whole session. We've got sessions coming up on the 13th of November, 20th and the 27th of November. All Tuesday mornings, 10:30 till 12:30. And if you talk to Catherine Burks on 0116 454 0659. She'll be able to take your details. You could just let us know you were coming along. You'd be able to make something on the day, but it'd be great to meet some new people, and you could then come and meet all of us.
And once again, for more details, call 0116 454 0659.
And now on Newsline, the return of an old friend of mine, an old friend of yours. Sounds like a radio
it thing. Does, doesn't it? Yeah.
We did a bit of radio, didn't we, years ago?
We did, long ago. Yes, we did.
So the return of Dave Angel.
Hello.
Now, Dave, recently it was Braille Week.
Yes, it was.
And you did a bit for our website, I believe.
About I Braille. Did, yes.
And I will ask you the question, I think, that you were asked on that piece. Yeah. You're a Braille reader, a Braille user. Do you think it's still as popular now as it ever was? Are people taking it up like they did?
I'm not sure that they're getting educated in it like they did, because you've got such things as voice recognition, and you've many of the blind people go into sighted schools rather than to specialist schools, and therefore when the little children are taught things, I'm not sure how well they're taught Braille, but Braille is a wonderful media in the sense that you can read it under the bedclothes, you've got complete privacy, you don't need any electronics and nothing to help you do it. It's a purely physical material thing on paper. There are Braille machines, obviously, which are electronic, but Braille itself can just be Brailled on a manual machine, on a mechanical machine. And I think it's a wonderful medium, and I'd be very sad if it died out.
Yeah, you mentioned the electronics. There's a lot of people got smartphones and devices that can do all sorts of things, which, of course, is a great asset if you've got it.
Yes.
Do you think because of that, people maybe don't take up the Braille option?
Well, I think it's a possibility. Obviously, Braille isn't as popular as it used to be, but actually it would be a good thing if it was actually brought back in. I know there aren't so many blind people as there used to be who are young blind people, because a lot of the conditions which caused young children to go blind have now been treated and can be controlled, and they don't lose all their sight. But and then at the other end of the spectrum, when you're old or you're getting older, your fingers aren't sensitive enough to learn Braille. But for those who did learn Braille, it's a media which should be preserved, really, because I think it's marvellous. And you can get very fast. When Louis Braille invented it in the 1830s or whenever it was, he was in the institute in France, because he was blinded as a boy by being infected by some needles that he accidentally pricked himself with. His father worked in used to work from home, and the boy was playing with these needles and he hurt himself and he got infected and he lost his sight. And he ended up in the institution for the blind in France, and he became an organist. But he also discovered that they had very slow methods of learning to read and write, and they had these raised letters which some wise French doctor had invented. But he decided that he would invent a system of his own based on the military, who used a series of dots at night for doing reading by night when it was dark. And he copied that idea and invented his own system, the Braille system. And it was frowned on for years by the French authorities. It took him ages to get it accepted. And not long after Braille was accepted as a media, he died, which was very sad. But we still have it to this day. You know? It's a marvellous system. You can get great speed. You can read a Braille book at the speed that a person reads a print book.
Is that right?
Yes, you can. If you get competent enough, you can. Because it uses contractions and it uses word signs and things. And if you know them and you've known them from your youth, you can get very fast. The only thing is, you're not often a very good speller, because a lot of the words are encapsulated in these signs and symbols. But there's one Braille letter which Louis Braille didn't invent, and that's W, because the French don't have it. So that had to be invented. But that's Braille. It's a wonderful system.
Thanks for that, Dave. Of course, the real reason you came in to talk to us was to tell us about your rather interesting birthday present you had recently.
Oh, yes. I was 60 not long ago, not so long ago, and my son-in-law, Ben, he decided to give me a very special present, which was a simulated skydive at Twin Woods in Milton Ernest, which is sort of near Northamptonshire, Leicestershire. No, it's not. It's Northamptonshire, Bedfordshire it is. And it's the most advanced place for training pilots. They used to use it for training pilots to jump out of planes and things. And now it's turned into like a recreation area where anyone can go and enjoy a flight. And I went in there and had a flight in July it was. And it was very exciting and different.
It's not in a plane then?
No, it's not in a plane. You actually go into a building, up a flight of steps, or several flights of steps, and then you are taken into a room where you have to dress in a special suit, jumpsuit, and you put goggles on and earplugs in your ears because of the winds, the 180-mile-an-hour winds you see. So you have to put plugs in your ears to protect them. You also wear a helmet over your head to protect your head in case you fly up and hit the top. And then you wait your turn and an instructor comes out and leads you to the doorway. Well, he did me anyway, because obviously not being able to see, I couldn't just dive in. And you go head first into this tunnel and you have to lie forward with your hands out to the sides, your arms out to the sides and your hands sort of in front of you. And how you position yourself is going to affect how you fly in there. And your feet are off the ground, you're flying in the air. I went up about 80, 85 feet. I've got videos of it somewhere. And I was spun round and round and went for a real flight with these instructors. Went for two of them. They take you in once, you have a good fly around, and if they don't think you're up to it, they won't let you in again. They take you straight out. They will, if you get into trouble, they will take you out and get you through the door and back out into the air again. But it was very scary, and it was fun as well.
So what is it? Is it like, is it air?
Fan blows from underneath you.
Yeah.
And blows a great column of air up at you at about 180 miles an hour. So that's why you're goggled and you have headphones in and with earplugs on and everything. So what makes it really scary is you can't hear hardly anything. You can't hear the instructors. All you can hear is the roar of the wind as you go into the wind tunnel. And you feel yourself being lifted into the air. And you can feel, because you've got a strap on each shoulder, they can control you. As long as you stay still in the position that they train you to be in, you can be controlled by them and they'll spin you around and take you up high and you can do all sorts of things as if you were coming down from a plane. And in fact, if the floor was taken away, you'd still be in the air. But you are actually flying, so it's very exciting.
It sounds it, yeah.
Yes.
So what's your next birthday present going to be? A real parachute jump, do you think?
Well, there's a thing at Great Yarmouth where you can sit in a ball and they take it up on a big, big sort of elevator thing up to the top and then they ping you off and you go flying down. I think I might have a go at that.
What, like a similar to a bungee jump?
Yeah, sort of, although I wouldn't want to do a bungee jump because you're hanging upside down. You sit in a case in this one. I'd like that better. But I might have a go at that. I've also fancied a hot air balloon ride, but they sound a bit tame after the flight, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Apparently they're very, very, very quiet, aren't they? Because you can hear everything on the ground.
Oh, absolutely. And that roar, as they go up. Yeah, that's right.
Marvellous.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks ever so much, Dave, for coming in. Yeah. When you do something else, come and let us know.
I will. I'll let you know all about it. But I would recommend it to anybody. But if anyone says they're not scared, they're probably lying, because it is terrifying.
It sounds terrifying.
Yeah, and the thought, I wouldn't have done it had Ben not bought it for me.
No, but you wouldn't have volunteered it.
No, I wouldn't. But once I'd done it, because, of course, the big thing was I was sitting there being all brave because I knew they'd spent a lot of money to do it. And I was sort of feeling all, I've got to be brave. I mustn't show him I'm scared. Then he come up because he went in too and did one. And he says, it looks terrible because you can see other people through the glass, you see. And I thought, oh, no, what do you do it for then? But I went in and we did it. And it was wonderful. And I don't regret it. It was great fun. But I was terrified.
What are you going to do when it's your son-in-law's birthday? How are you going to get your own back?
I think I'll buy him a bag of spiders.
Oh, now you're talking scary.
Yeah.
Well, thanks ever so much, Dave, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Cheerio, everybody. Look after yourselves.
And that's just about it for this edition of Newsline. Thanks to Paul Bott, Julie Rudd from the New Wycliffe Home, Teresa and Hayley from the Kathleen Rutland Home, Vanessa, who was telling us about park runs. Thanks to Ken Russell and Jamie McCrill, Dave Angel, Colette, and also thank you to Catherine, Christine, Marissa, Colin and Fiona from Pottery Sight Loss. Thanks to Naina and Venetia from the Vista Mobile Support Services, and thanks to Josh at the Phoenix talking to us about their audio-described films. If you'd like to find out more, you can look at the Vista website, www.vistablind.org.uk. There's always plenty of information on there. If you'd like to call the helpline, the number is 0116 249 8839. Thank you for listening. Hope you enjoyed Newsline. We'll be back again for the next edition.